So wonderful to be here with you all. I don't know how long it's been since I've been here, a few years at least, and I loved being in this pulpit. I feel so centered in this pulpit. Most of you know that I was the pastor here for almost a year, and it was just a really wonderful experience. I love this church. It's a really beautiful place, and the church is the people, eh? But it really is a beautiful place to be in. Wow! And then Barbara told me she had this made this rainbow flag. And talking about Barbara, I think a really good thing about having me here betwixt Barbara and Maggie is that maybe my accent makes that transition for you all. Mine's a mongrel, you know? It's kind of like turned into a thousand things since I've been in the States for, I don't know how many years, 30-something years. South African. And of course, I was here in this very pulpit the Sunday after 9/11. Now, most of us sort of say to ourselves, like, where was I on 9/11? And boy, I remember being here the Sunday afterwards and being in this sort of existential angst, you know. I mean, what do you say as a pastor on a Sunday that follows that Tuesday? And I remember I read Psalm 23 and I said some words and I read some other scriptures and I said some, and it's all like a fog to me. But nevertheless, I think we were all in that place, and I think just being in that place myself probably, you know, connected with everybody else's space. And of course, the Sundays after that. But I just wanted to say one thing about that. I'll never forget that day and week. I have a really good story of the day, but I'm not going to share that now. But I do remember, you know, I was the interim pastor here, just for 10 months. So there was no imperative for me to be a resident of San Francisco. I lived in Novato at the time. And I remember, like, watching everything like everybody else and thinking, you know, I just really needed to be at church. You know, be as a pastor, be there, because, you know, people will be experiencing things and people might be visiting or whatever, but just to be there. Of course, I felt a little worried traveling over the Golden Gate Bridge, number one. But, you know, the interesting thing is, I don't know if any of you were around in the city, you know, wandering around the city on that day, but I came in just afternoon, and I remember driving up Van Ness Avenue. The place was a ghost town. There wasn't a car, there wasn't a person to be seen. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine Van Ness with absolutely no one on the road? It was eerie, really. You know, and but boy, I remember that. I don't think you'll ever see San Francisco with a street that empty as it was on that very day. I think people just left the city or went inside. Okay, that was then. My sermon today is reflections on the weeks at the beginning of summer, shortly before I was asked to preach here. So I was asked to preach here, so I started getting into gear, you know. So what do I speak about? The events encapsulated swaths of my life and ministry that I thought I'd pack them into a sermon as good news. And the sermon has actually turned into like a celebration. But of course, you know, all celebrations, all good news comes out of the underside. So every good piece of good news you share, there's a bit of bad news perhaps that preceded it. You know, not only in your own life, but in society, in life at large. And that's where I'm basically coming from today. So in the time, the Pope had released an earth-shaking encyclical letter on the environment, and that accounts for all the environmental themes in the liturgy today. The Confederate flag came under fire after its association with the killing of 9 AME church members in Charleston, South Carolina. And the Supreme Court made same-sex marriage legal in every state of the Union. Three big things. Now, can you imagine? I'm going to be preaching on all those things today in like 10 minutes. That's quite a challenge. But it's shocking that a person would sit in a Bible study and then, still in the realm of allegedly, open fire on class members with the intention to kill them. Now imagine that African American churches and perhaps mosques around the country have to consider having bodyguards in their places of study and worship. It's a sad indictment indeed. Our prayers continue to go out to the members, family, and friends of the Charleston worshiping community, as well as to all beleaguered communities across the country. We must eradicate racism, discrimination, and violence. Wow, the history of violence, eh? And I know in I know in my sermon today I'm sort of carrying coals to Newcastle. Newcastle, isn't that in Scotland? Not England. Okay, those coal towns in England. My sermon is a kind of catch-up of these major events. I address them briefly since they touch us in various ways and have important implications for our lives as Christians. In my 30 years of ministry, all these areas have challenged me personally and have been the wrestling ground for the church locally and nationally and internationally. One of my most beautiful and vivid memories is an ecumenical sunrise service on the beach near Jacksonville, Florida. I was a pastor at Riverside Presbyterian Church in Jacksonville at the time. And the sunrise service commemorated Earth Day in the late 80s, when Earth Day was still in its infancy. The director of Earth Day Jacksonville was a member of the church I served at the time, and she asked me to preach the sermon during the sunrise service. During my sermon, the sun cast pink and yellow hues over a clean, calm sea with seagulls and pelicans flying serenely by. And the congregation faced the rising sun. Beautiful morning, very vivid. The beauty of the Pope's encyclical letter on the environment is its biblical underpinnings and its challenge to industry and concern for the poor who are most adversely affected by climate change. We all will be harmed if we do not do all we can to live more sustainably. Humanity's so-called dominion of the earth, you know that biblical phrase that we will have dominion of the earth? So humanity's so-called dominion of the earth becomes stewardship of the earth in concert with the rest of Scripture read today, and in concert with a more holistic theology. Dominion is really God's dominion, which is care for the earth and its people. A just king, a king that affirms peace with justice. Now, our denomination has been a leader in the area. Go online and type in the search space Presbyterian and environment, and you'll get the church's position. You'll see that the Presbyterian General Assemblies have been speaking on issues of environmental protection and justice since the 1960s. Their witness ranges broadly from drinking water safety and acid rain, to protecting endangered species, to cleaning up dirty power plants, to climate change and U.S. energy policy. The Assembly's major policy statements on the environment were in 1971, 1990, and on energy in 1981. Our dependence on fossil fuels and the encouragement towards renewables is under discussion by the GA, at the GA level right now, basically through overtures of both San Francisco and the Redwoods Presbyteries. And, you know, I'm a pastor of the Redwoods Presbytery right now. Roman Catholics and Protestants have come a long way in joining hands and hearts. It takes the sinking of our world to do so. There are no atheists in foxholes, or more appropriate for us, no divisions in the trenches. Now, the Confederate flag controversy. The headline of an op-ed article in the Chronicle, written by New York University history professor Jonathan Zimmerman, caught my attention. This is what the headline read. It read, "Bring down symbol, not memory of fallen." Needless to say, racism, ethnicism, classism, and other isms are roundly frowned upon by the church at large. They violate the biblical injunction that all people are created in God's image and therefore have dignity and worth. I remember visiting South Africa in the years after the historic free and fair elections for all the citizens, and I actually was an international election observer at those elections. And in the team with me that went over there was, guess who? Al Sharpton. I got to know Al really well on that trip. He was really kind of quite outspoken in those days. He was a kind of a rabid radical, you know. You saw him on TV and you wanted to hide from that guy. But he was the kindest, gentlest, most beautiful person when you were in this close company with him. I loved the guy, you know. Anyway, so I was in South Africa and during those historic elections, and I think this was a few years after the historic elections. You know, I go back to South Africa from time to time. It's kind of like a movie, you know, three weddings and a funeral. That's why I go back to South Africa. So I think it was a few years afterwards, and I was walking into this food market area, the parking lot, and this guy pulls up in this light truck, and in the back of the truck, you know, in the back of the window where they hang their guns, well, there was a gun hanging there, and below the window was the Confederate flag in South Africa. I couldn't believe it. So I thought, well, I'm going to go up to this guy, and I'm going to ask him what that flag means. Now, of course, I knew what the flag meant to me, but I was really curious to see what it meant to him. So he said vehemently, "Kill the Kaffirs." Now, Kaffir in South Africa is the N-word in the United States. And then I saw him drive off, and I thought to myself, he's a dead man. The Charleston accused killer, Dylan Roof, displayed on his website the Confederate flag and the flags of apartheid South Africa and Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Professor Zimmerman states that because of the nationalism and racial hatred the Confederate flag engenders, it must come down, but not monuments to Confederate Army victims in the Civil War. You know, at the time, there were people who were actually defacing these monuments, and he was pretty upset with it. Referring to the patriotic sacrifice of the Southern soldiers, he writes, "To be sure, these men were on the wrong side of history, but they are part of our history, no matter our politics, race, or region. The Confederate flag needs to come down, and it will. But everything else should stand now and forever so we can remember who we were. That's the only way for us to figure out, as a single nation, what we want to become." Jacksonville was a southern state city and had all the sensibilities of a southern perspective on the Civil War. Now, they actually called Jacksonville the northernmost city in southern Georgia. So you can get a sense of where that was coming from, you know? A member of the church, by the way, when I first arrived, I discovered that a member of the church was on the committee of the United Daughters of, no, what's it called? Yeah, the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And so there I am in my first week, and she asks me to perform a memorial service for the Confederate war dead. So I was fresh out of seminary, newly arrived from South Africa, I lived in a black township in South Africa with the leading black theologians at the time. So I had a pretty much of a consciousness on all this stuff. And of course, I agreed to do it. And then I read a book on the Civil War the night before to refresh my knowledge. And of course, I disagreed with everything I read. But I was going to do that service the very next day. And I think Barbara has a sense of this. Pastors get into these situations. And yet I felt it important to officiate at the service because these folk, whether you like it or not, they were still mourning the loss of their loved ones and perhaps a loss of a way of life, a way of life that I didn't really quite go for, but anyway. So there we trudged through this old Civil War gravesite. I mean, all the nice manicured, you know, current day memorial, you know, graveyard was all nicely done. But this old Civil War grave, that grass and weeds were growing like this, and these ancient stones were sitting there. So anyway, we trudged through those things, and I led the service in this among these gravestones. And I walked the fine line of respecting and recognizing their grief, while at the same time mentioning that I hoped we would never have a repeat of such events. It's an opportunity for a pastor to be in situations like that. God wanted equality among the races and peace with justice, I went on to say. Now, everyone was actually happy with my message and prayers. And after the service, we had the best southern fish fry that you can ever imagine having. In the backyard of this guy's house, with a big bucket of boiling oil, chunks of fish dipped into, have you ever been to a southern fish fry? Big fish ducked into their oil, sizzle, 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 onto a plate with coleslaw and grits. You know what I mean? It was just, of course, you know, rolled in batter first and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, you know, the whole thing, you know? Anyway, I'll never forget that fish fry. Finally, the Supreme Court decision allowing same-sex marriages in every state. According to a Chronicle article, June 29, for more than a century, justices have argued over whether the Constitution is a living document with rights that can be redefined and expanded over time, or whether its language must be interpreted strictly as the drafters would have understood it. Guess what? Justice Antonin Scalia, a leading exponent of the latter view, has proclaimed the virtues of a dead constitution. Speaking for the court majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said, "Rights come not from ancient sources alone. They rise, too, from a better informed understanding of how constitutional imperatives define a liberty that remains urgent in our own era." In past marriages, he went on to say, in past marriage rulings, which presumed that spouses were of opposite sexes, the court, like many institutions, has made assumptions defined by the world and time of which it is a part. Those assumptions, he said, came from a period in which much of the health profession considered homosexuality an illness, rather than a normal expression of human sexuality as psychiatrists now recognize. That awareness, he said, leads inevitably to the conclusion that there is dignity in the bond between two men or two women who seek to marry and in their autonomy to make such profound choices protected by the constitutional rights to both liberty and equality. Okay. Now, one of the issues for the church is whether society, like the Supreme Court, defines the church or the church defines society. Presbyterians in our denomination and other mainline churches can say in this case that they have been in the forefront of defining the issue. And the person who comes immediately to mind for Old First is our dearly departed, Pam Byers. Such an excellent advocate of this. Probably one of the best in the United States, member of this church. In June, our constitution, a living, changing, reforming constitution, permitted pastors to perform same-gender marriages in states that allowed it. That's in the beginning of June. And at the end of June, the whole country changed. Now, all states permit it. The Presbyterian Church USA has advocated for almost four decades for civil rights for LGBT persons. The decision by the U.S. Supreme Court is in keeping with that work. It's good to really remind ourselves of things like that. It makes you feel good about being church. You know, when you struggle and struggle and struggle and things don't happen, and they eventually happen because of our faithfulness. Yeah, we can do it. We can do it. Sue Willen is at a Rosie the Riveter at a Guinness Book of World Record breaking event last weekend. She'll tell you about it. Yes, they did it. They broke the record. But she'll tell you about that. Now, another challenge of factions in the church that disagree with same-sex marriage is whether it is biblically sound. Now, you guys have gone through that, those waters before. We all have. According to the Covenant Network of Presbyterians, the Bible does not contemplate the possibility of... The Bible does not contemplate the possibility of same-gender marriage. But many who stand under the authority of Scripture today, in the spirit of the ever-widening understanding of who's included in the love and grace of God, have concluded that biblical moral logic values committed mutual loving partnerships, regardless of the gender of the partners. My friends, Linda, a United Church of Christ pastor, and Susan, a teacher who live in Jacksonville, Florida, can now enjoy living with full rights in their state, which they had to leave a couple of years ago to get married in San Francisco. They've been together for over 20 years. So while we have moved recently into a new world, there's still much of the old in it, not to make us complacent. Nevertheless, let us celebrate the strides for good that the church and society made in the 3 weeks that began the summer of 2015. Amen.